This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This school year was supposed to be the year when the new Common Core education standards were fully in place. But a backlash has developed against the program in states from Indiana to Louisiana to Arizona to a handful of districts here in the Granite State. Concerns often include Common Core's content, the testing associated with it, and fears that it represents a so-called national takeover of local schools. But as these current arguments rage, our guest today says, we've been here before. We're talking this hour with journalist and author Dana Goldstein. Her new book is called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Goldstein says ever since we've had public education, we've had reform efforts like Common Core and plenty of pushback against them. And that's also the case, she says, with many other contemporary debates over education. From the start, we've argued about teacher tenure and pay, unions, school choice, and much more. Today in The Exchange, the teacher wars. Let's hear from you. Do you agree or not that the teaching profession in this country is embattled? And if so, why? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dana Goldstein joins us from New York City. And Dana, it's great to have you. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, following up on some of the language that you use, and wow, it's pretty strong, the most embattled profession. Also, you say in the book, we have a history in this country of moral panic targeting teachers. Give us a little more on that, Dana.
Yeah, so this concept of moral panic is something that sociologists have come up with, and I saw it in this 200-year history of teaching in America. In 1800, actually, 90% of American teachers were men, and reformers at the time thought this was a huge problem. They launched a big campaign calling male teachers alcoholics. They said they were violent toward children, and they used this to argue to change the teaching profession to be a female job. Women, of course, being cheaper to pay, it had a big benefit to the taxpayer, which was sort of the unspoken story back then. And then you come to the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, and immigrants are flooding into the classrooms. And at this time, you see reformers saying, you know, that teachers aren't tough enough. You know, they should be able to manage classrooms with as many as 60 children in them. 60 children. That was not unusual in the past. And then in the 1930s and 50s, you saw the Red Scare. So this fear, this panic, this anxiety that communist or radical left-wing teachers were going to brainwash American children. And we see thousands of teachers across the country witch hunted and lose their jobs because they may have expressed at the time left-wing political views. So again and again in American history, we see panic about teachers. I think today we panic about teacher tenure, things like that. And so it's really not new.
It's interesting. So some of the moral arguments that we have broadly in society, immigrants, communism, you write about the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement. Some of these moral dilemmas or big societal shifts are reflected in how we talk about teachers.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a great summary of the history. And what we see again and again is that Americans are concerned about inequality, and I think rightfully so. So in the 19th century, there was Catholics that were immigrating to the United States for the first time, and a big concern about differences between Catholics and Protestants. Into the 20th century, a concern about difference between immigrants and mainstream America, between blacks and whites. And today, really, between the poor and the middle class. And consistently, we see those anxieties put onto teachers that it's teachers' jobs to close these gaps and to kind of Americanize everyone. And this is an extremely high expectation. I think in many ways it's a fair expectation, but the question I ask in the book is, are we helping teachers to do this job, or are we simply, you know, giving them these high expectations and then stepping back?
Well, it's so interesting because when we do shows on education, we often get calls, Dana, from teachers who say, look, I'm being expected to solve all of society's problems. When I get poor children who haven't eaten breakfast, I get homeless children who don't know where they're going to sleep tonight. I get children with learning disorders. I get children whose parents are taking drugs or who are, by necessity, working five jobs and can't spend time, you know, helping with the homework or signing the permission slips and so forth. So here you have teachers today saying, I'm being asked to solve all of society's problems, and you're saying that's kind of always been the case.
Yeah, no, it has been, and I think if teachers, you know, get into the book, they'll read these stories of famous teachers, people like Lyndon B. Johnson. You know, he taught in a rural school in Texas, right on the Mexico border. The kids did not speak English, and he wrote home to his mom, will you please send toothpaste, because the kids did not have toothpaste. So the sorts of struggles that teachers have, often the necessity that they do social work in addition to education, it's not new.
Well, it's interesting. And I had forgotten until I read your book that LBJ actually was very much shaped by this experience, right, Dana? Teaching in a poor Mexican school.
Yeah, he was. And it was something he talked about a lot in the 60s when he presented the Great Society, his big anti-poverty push to the American people. You know, he said that teaching really taught him what poverty was. Before that, he didn't truly understand.
Well, again, the phone number for you to join us on The Exchange today. We're talking with author Dana Goldstein. Her brand new book is called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. The number 1-800-892-6477. If you're an educator or a past educator, we'd love to hear from you. Also, just as a parent or a taxpayer, we'd love to get your thoughts on Dana Goldstein's premise that teachers are America's most embattled profession. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And a little bit later on, Dana, we'll talk about how you write that, you know, teachers are not entirely blameless either. They are not innocent angels who, you know, have been picked on the whole time. I mean, they have some responsibility in this too. But I do want to get to some of the things that have made headlines. And one of those big ones that we've been talking about in New Hampshire is Common Core, Dana, the latest sort of flavor of the month in terms of education reform movements. How does this fit into the broader teacher war and the broader history of public education in this country?
Well, we've been fighting about what should get taught to kids for a very, very long time. And actually, our school system was crafted in the 19th century less to be about the academic curriculum, less to be about intellectual rigor, than really to be about character education and morality. There was this sense that teachers should be teaching children to be, you know, good and ethical human beings. And that was really the impetus for school reformers in the 19th century who started our common schools movement. You know, today we're much more focused on this idea of college for all, rigor, that we need to hold all kids to a high academic standard. And this is where the Common Core comes from. And really, what I say in the book is it's the first sort of politically viable attempt to have a national system that is the same from state to state in terms of what kids are learning in school. Importantly, it's not a curriculum itself. It doesn't tell kids what books to read. It doesn't tell teachers what they should assign. It's really skill-based. It talks about the skills the children should have in each grade level.
When you say the first politically viable, and there are themes in Common Core that, you, as you write, are, you know, we've seen before, but talk a little bit more about that, Dana, the first politically viable effort to have some kind of national standard.
Yeah, well, in the 80s and 90s, there were past attempts to have national standards, and they tended to become caught up in controversies over, you know, was evolution going to be part of it, or what about sex ed? Is the history curriculum going to be too critical of the United States? Are we going to look too much at America's flaws and not enough at the heroics of our founding fathers? So these sorts of debates in the 80s and 90s derailed politically past attempts to have national standards. I think the thing about the Common Core that was really innovative is that it wasn't written in Washington. It was written by a whole group of philanthropists and advocates. And then what they did is they went from state to state asking state legislatures to adopt this thing. And as you know, in New Hampshire, you know, most states did follow through and they did adopt it. But this hasn't prevented critics from saying, you know, we want more local control and we don't want to be part of this big national movement.
What about the philanthropic funding, the fact that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation really kind of got this started with its money? Is that problematic for the success or failure of Common Core? And have we seen philanthropists get involved in public education reform efforts before, Dana?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, going back to the 19th century, you had railroad industrialists, some of the first big supporters of the idea of compulsory education, the idea that parents were forced to send their kids to school, that they didn't have the choice to leave them home. So philanthropy in education is nothing new. It was, you know, people like Carnegie were big donors to public education efforts. With the Gates Foundation, they've had especially big impact because what happened when President Obama came into office is that he adopted many of the priorities of Bill Gates, and he found ways to put federal dollars toward Bill Gates' priorities. And the Common Core is one of those things. You know, President Obama and his administration, they didn't invent this idea. It predates them, and they didn't write the core. But they told states that they could get extra money if they adopt it. And so you have this convergence of federal education policy and philanthropy from Bill Gates. And what that leads to is this big top-down reform movement in which many local schools are feeling an onslaught of pressure to change.
And standardized testing is part of it too, right, Dana? And you know, we've always had concerns about standardized testing. I remember during No Child Left Behind, that was a big criticism as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most controversial part of the Common Core is the fact that it's not just a set of standards for teachers to reach for, but there's going to be high-stakes tests that are attached to this. And of course, you know, for-profit companies make the tests, and the tests are generally multiple choice. They're not very high quality in many cases. And teachers are going to be evaluated based on how kids do on these tests. And whether that will happen this year or next year or in 2 years, it differs state to state. But these tests are not just to know how well our kids are doing. They're to hold the whole system accountable. So we're rolling out a big change to schools. And at the same time, we're asking schools, you know, this is going to be an accountability measure for you. And oftentimes the adults that work in the schools feel that they don't have the time to learn how to do this well.
Well, and they're doing all the other social work that you talked about earlier, in addition to adapting to the new standards. In just a moment, Dana, we will take a short break. But when we come back, I do want to ask the question about unions. Some people would say if teachers are indeed embattled, it's partly the fault of teacher unions and their positions that they sometimes take. So we'll talk about that after a break, get some of the history of teacher unions, and of course, hear from you. The number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at a new book called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Author Dana Goldstein joins us, and let's hear from you. Do you agree or not that the teaching profession in this country is embattled? If so, why do you feel that way? If not, why not? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dana, before we go to our listeners, I did want to ask you about the unions, because you write about this a lot in your book. Some folks would say, you know, the unions are part of the problem. What's your perspective on the role that unions have played, for better or for worse, in terms of how your average American feels about teachers?
When we talk about the unions, it's important to acknowledge that only 7% of American private sector workers are in unions. So for a lot of people, their kids' teacher might be the only person they know who is unionized. So I try in the book to demystify these organizations a little bit by telling their history. They start in 1897, really because teaching is at the time about 97% female in major cities like New York and Chicago. And the teachers in those places are quite angry. Their pay is basically a factory-level wage. And they get together as sort of a women's rights organization to argue that, you know, this pay discrimination against women workers is not fair. And over the coming decades, they have quite a lot of success in making teaching a middle-class job, which it truly was not. It was really a working-class job before the unions changed this. And along the way, they win this very controversial right, tenure. Tenure dates back to 1909. It was borrowed from the German education system. At the time, it was something school reformers actually supported. In addition to unions, they thought that it would help offset the low pay, that it would help attract good teachers to the profession with this promise of job security. It was a way to make sure teaching was not overly politicized, that a teacher couldn't get fired because she was pregnant or because she had a controversial political view. So tenure has become more controversial over time as fewer and fewer other American workers have these sorts of benefits.
What about the resentment? I think you write about this, Dana, that some people outside the education system feel, you know, that teachers have tenure, they have health benefits, they have vacation, they have retirement, that many other workers would love to have these days. How does that resentment play into the union criticism or the teacher wars for that matter?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And it's really true. I mean, a lot of us, whether we work in a blue-collar field or a white-collar field, we're experiencing less and less work-life balance, longer hours. We contribute more to our health plans or we have to pay for them entirely for ourselves. Of course, pensions are now almost totally a myth in the private sector. So the fact that teachers have generous health benefits, they have pensions, they have tenure protections, I mean, I think it's natural that other Americans look at this and they say, why are teachers so different from the rest of us, and do they deserve this extra protection?
So does that create harsher criticism of teacher unions than other unions, you know, electricians unions or auto worker unions?
I think it creates harsher criticism of teachers than some of those other professions because many more of us know teachers than potentially people in those other jobs. I mean, 4% of all civilian workers are teachers. 3.4 million Americans are teachers. And so these huge numbers and, you know, the prominence that teachers play in the community, I think, you know, means in many cases that there's more political focus on the job. One of the questions I often ask is how come police don't have this level of resentment toward the sort of similar protections that they enjoy? But that's an open question.
Right. Police unions, firemen unions, and so forth. Even civil service workers, you know, the unions get criticized, but perhaps not to the extent that the teacher unions do. Go ahead. Maybe it's about the kids. Maybe it's about those summers off. A lot of people have resentment around that.
Yeah, no, I think summers off is a good point. I think the fact that, of course, we're all emotional about our children, which is totally reasonable. I mean, this is an awesome responsibility that teachers have to be with our kids all day. And also, I have to bring up that teaching is 76% female, and a lot of those other jobs are predominantly male. And I think, you know, the fact that it's a women's profession, unfortunately, leads to this bias that it's not a very tough job, and it's something that mothers do, and it's a good balance with, you know, getting home to cook dinner or having the summer off. In reality, if you know a teacher, you know the hours are often tougher in many cases than those of us who have office jobs, but these cultural stereotypes persist.
Are you saying that some of the criticism is sexism or sort of disdain for the mommy track?
Yeah, I do think that's true, and I trace this through history. You know, I'm not just inventing this, but I see from the 19th century till today, the idea that teaching is a women's profession has shaped how it's discussed, and it's often talked about almost as volunteer work or as a romantic calling, something that people are so mission-driven to do that we don't need to worry about pay and working conditions and these pragmatic or practical questions. But of course, pay and working conditions and all that, that's as important to teachers as it is to any other working adult.
And so one more question about the unions, and then we will go to our listeners. So again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. There's one famous quote, and I think you know where I'm going with this, Dana. Albert Shanker, one of the big union, teacher union organizers and leaders in the 20th century, he had that famous quote. He said, "I'm in it for the teachers, not for the kids." This is the concern that you hear again and again and again, that the teachers' unions are primarily about protecting teachers and they're less concerned about, you know, the children, the quality of our public schools.
Right. So he did say this in 1968, something similar to your paraphrase, and it is quoted again and again, to attack the unions. And look, we know that teacher tenure, sometimes it protects teachers for good reasons, and often, unfortunately, it does protect ineffective teachers. And so, you know, I think it's fair to hold the unions accountable for that and ask them to change. However, one thing I always bring up is there's other policies that the unions fight for, such as, say, universal free pre-K, which are shown by research to really help children have better outcomes. So in some cases, do union positions appear to have a negative impact on children? Absolutely. In other cases, the unions are some of the most powerful, well-organized forces we have to fight for things that can actually help kids do better.
Again, the guest today is Dana Goldstein. The new book is The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And no matter what the topic, when it comes to public education, it turns out that we've been there before, whether it's standardized tests, arguments about unions, and so forth. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dana, let's go to our listeners. Ken's calling from Antrim. Hi, Ken. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Ken. Both my parents were educators. Excuse me. And my father used to always tell me, he was a physicist, the Common Core is too stuck into what is the answer. Just get me the answer instead of why did you get that answer or how did you get that answer. And it just basically is rote memorization, which is proven not to work.
Go ahead, Ken.
And well, that's really about it. And it's just a silly thing to have a universal Common Core type thing when teaching skills are different in every teacher, every school, every state.
Here's a question for you, Ken, and I'll ask you, since both your parents were educators. The flip side of the Common Core argument is that, you know, standards are too different from state to state, and a kid moves from district to district or state to state, and my goodness, he or she can't keep up, or, you know, who knows what the differences are between Kentucky and New Hampshire, and businesses need some assurance that at least there's a basic level of understanding that every kid in America will have. I wonder what you think about that. That's kind of the other side of the argument, isn't it?
Well, it is, but at the same time, it's the sad point is that there is a difference between each state when really we should be educating our children the best possible way we can everywhere. And so, I mean, it is hopefully going to help, but at the same time, it's just going to be another cookie-cutter type machine sending kids out with very little common sense and being able to figure out how to do things on their own without formulas and just, you know.
Not big thinkers, it sounds like you're saying.
Yes.
Just rote memorization. Yeah, and Ken, thank you so much for the call. You know, Dana, I remember, I've been doing this job long enough to remember that this was the exact same criticism leveled at No Child Left Behind. Rote memorization, filling in the bubble, you know, not creating big thinkers, but sort of widget turners. What do you think?
Well, it's definitely true. I mean, Ken is correct that conceptual thinking and questioning and being able to back arguments with evidence and figure out, you know, how fractions work, not just how to add these particular two fractions together. You know, those are the questions we want kids to be tackling and mastering. But I don't think it's a fair criticism of the Common Core to say that it doesn't focus on conceptual thinking. In fact, that is the entire point of the Common Core, to move away from rote memorization. The issue that we see is that it's often being implemented very poorly. But when the Common Core comes up, I always, you know, encourage people to go onto the website, and if you have the time, to actually look at the standards themselves, which I've done, and I think they're quite good, actually. They are conceptual. They are about big thinking. But oftentimes, the way they're being rolled out in schools, it's not having the intended effect.
Thanks a lot again for that call, Ken. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. David is up next from where? Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to speak a little bit more toward the union aspect of pretty much any position in America, not just teachers and whatnot. You know, you do see a lot of jealousy when you run into people who don't have union, but when you talk to them and you finally figure out the real problem is they're being underpaid. And that seems to be the point that's missed on a regular basis. When it comes to education, the unions are not there to educate the children. The teachers and the administration are. And if you've got a bad teacher who's coming up on tenure, well, you've known that's a bad teacher for a long time. For whatever reason, you haven't moved on that, and that is the problem. It's passing the buck and then blaming the union.
So the problem is not so much that unions fight for better pay, David. It's that they help less good teachers, bad teachers, if you want to call them that, stay on. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is that union contracts include the capacity for the other end to be able to pursue disciplinary action and to keep good teachers on. So if you have a problem teacher, the union has no problem with taking care of making sure that you have good personnel on board. Their problem is that they have to protect who is paying them benefits. However, on the other side, all along, you know, by the time you get to a 30-year career, this person has bumped into a number of people who know they're not qualified, and they did nothing about it.
Okay.
And that's the problem. It's not the union to get rid of union personnel. It's up to them to step up and, you know, and stop passing the buck and just blame the union.
David, thanks a lot for calling in. And I want to let you know, Dana, we also got an email from Ray in Whitefield on a similar point. He says, tenure does not mean a job for life. He says teachers only want due process. You touched on this before, Dana, but go ahead back there because Ray's interested and so is David.
Yeah, so Ray and David make an important point, and I do like to define what tenure actually is just so that people can understand it because it gets talked about so much and we rarely talk about what the process means. So depending on the state, it can take, you know, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years to earn tenure. Once you have it, you can get fired, but here's what needs to happen. Your supervisor, say the principal, needs to gather evidence that you're failing at your job, and then they're going to present that evidence in something that looks a little bit like a trial and a neutral arbitrator, so it could be a panel of peer teachers or in many cases it's someone like a judge, makes a decision about whether that evidence, you know, actually proves that the teacher was bad and, you know, whether or not the teacher is going to go back to the classroom. So a process does exist, and it is the administrator's responsibility to actually go through that process.
That sounds pretty involved.
It is involved, and, you know, that's a good point because oftentimes in practice, it takes a very long time and can become expensive for schools to pursue these hearings. And, you know, sometimes a teacher earns tenure because they were great in year three, but in year 15, they're not good anymore. And there does have to be a process for dealing with that. And it has to be an achievable process. It can't be so long, so involved, and so expensive that it's impossible to do. And so, you know, what I argue for in the book, like, yes, due process for teachers, but it has to be streamlined. And we need to bring unions and reformers to the table together to discuss how to change and reform and improve this system. I don't think cutting the unions out of the equation is a good idea. I think there's a lot of good reasons why teaching is a unionized job.
But there are some changes in teacher unions, you're saying, Dana, that might improve, you know, not just their public image, but our public schools.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because the process you describe now, I can hear an administrator saying, well, I have a teacher who's not great, but he or she isn't terrible, and I really don't have the time and energy to go through that process that you just outlined.
Mm-hmm. And principals are really busy, and they've become busier and busier
sure.
in recent years with all these new reforms on them. So, yeah, you know, in practice, a lot of times a principal waits till the situation gets really, really bad before they pursue something like this.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, David, and for the email, Ray. You can give us a call, too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Jane's in Hillsboro. Hi, Jane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say something about having grown up in New York during, like, the 70s, and they had these tests that all New York kids had to take called Regents. And I remember, this is just a little anecdote, I was in trigonometry, and the teacher was talking about multiplying fractions or dividing fractions. And the key to it is that you're supposed to take the second fraction and invert it. So I raised my hand and said, I don't understand the concept. And because these teachers were so pressured to get us to get good grades on the Regents, this is what he said to me. He said, yours is not to question why, just invert and multiply.
At least you made it rhyme, Jane. Huh?
Yeah, no, I remember that because and that's what he said, and that made me not understand that concept. And for all of the math classes I took, they taught it in such a way. All they wound up doing is teaching us how to pass past Regents tests, and I wound up, I felt like negative learning, just passing the test and forgetting or not understanding any of the things that would have made me know a little bit of math today. So for certain people, and I know the big pressure in the days that I went to school was all about pass the Regents. And
so that we look good as a district, yeah.
So that we look good, and these teachers, you know, everybody got merit by that. And there's different ways of learning, and I know because I've grown up finding a little, you know, finding those different paths. Anyway, I think you understand my concept.
Sure. Yeah. Jane, thank you very much for calling in. And this is the concern we always hear that we've sort of heard from a couple of the people already this morning, Dana, that some of these reform efforts, well-intentioned though they might be, you know, just end up being rote memorization and sort of putting things in little boxes and not really thinking about it.
Yeah, so I grew up in New York and attended public school here, so I took the Regents tests, and I know exactly what the caller is talking about. And one thing a lot of people who think about education have realized that American math education is particularly terrible. We really do...
Terrible?
Yes, we do obsessively focus on teaching kids how to do problems kind of in a mechanical sense, and we don't encourage kids to ask questions about the concepts underlying it. And unfortunately, teachers are often not well-trained in how to answer those conceptual questions, or some of them, sadly, don't understand the concepts themselves because teachers are products of this same system of bad math education. So the Common Core actually set out to fix some of these problems, and I think it's an open question whether it will work or not. Retraining teachers is a really important part to making these types of changes, and oftentimes we don't have the funding or the time available to teach teachers to become more effective, say, math educators. Instead, we just kind of, you know, we hand them a new packet and we expect them to implement it. And at that level, reform often does not work.
All right. Well, Jane, thanks for the call. And coming up in just a moment, Dana, I'm going to ask you about the feminization of the teaching force that you touched on earlier and what the impact of having so few men involved in public education is. We'll talk about that after a break, and let's hear from you. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Dana Goldstein. She's the author of the brand new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And we're hearing from you. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here in The Exchange. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. As we're learning through Dana's book, many, many of the contemporary debates we have about education, whether it's standardized tests or the feminization of the workforce or teacher unions, have been with us for a long, long time. Join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Dana, here's an email from Robert in Epsom, getting back to our earlier conversation about teachers as social workers. Robert says, maybe teachers have always been social workers, but that doesn't make it right. Are teachers educated to be social workers? Also, would this not influence the pay of real social workers downwards? Next, in states like New Hampshire, where local municipal budgets are split between town and school, does this not muddy the water in accounting for where funds are directly needed, making it harder to particularly identify problem areas? Shouldn't teachers be able to delegate to welfare officers? This is a great set of questions, Robert. Thank you very much. And, you know, without addressing each of those individually, he raises a great point, Dana. Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, I agree completely with the point that he's making in the email. And one thing I'll mention is that Americans often talk about Finland, this tiny country the size of New Jersey, as a model for our schools. And it's true, they do have wonderful public schools there. One of the things that I learned when I was able to visit Finland and report on the schools is that they have this wonderfully strong social safety net outside the schools. So, you know, parents can drop their kids off 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at a daycare center that's funded by the government where a college-educated child care worker will care for your child. And you can do this when your baby is 2 months old, you know, all the way through childhood. There's universal health care, you know, there's basically no child poverty, no child hunger. you know, no child homelessness. When you take all this together and you think about how the job of the teacher is different in a high poverty community in the United States, it becomes really hard to compare our system to a system like that.
Well, since your book is a historical take, I wonder if over time or at different parts of the country over time, teachers have said to, you know, their municipalities, to their local welfare offices, look, help us out here.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. One of the things I noticed, you know, for 200 years is that often the best teachers become very concerned about this idea of wraparound services. They become very committed to trying to get kids all the other services they need outside the school, whether it's, you know, better nutrition, better health care, better child care if the parents are working five jobs, as you mentioned earlier. Money is the limiting factor. You know, we have pretty low taxes in the United States. We're not funding the wraparound services that children need.
Let's take another call if we could. Thanks for that email a lot, Robert. And Gretel is calling from Brownsville, Vermont. Hi, Gretel. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for the discussion. I'm a school teacher, and somehow we've neglected to talk about how much education teachers need to become teachers. I teach science and math, and I had degrees in chemistry, mathematics, and then I had to go back to school and get a master's in education. So when you talk about remuneration or our level of pay, most people with those kinds of degrees would be making a lot more than we are. And we're really well educated, and I think that needs to be talked about a little bit more, and I'll leave it to you guys. But
yeah.
We work really hard to become teachers.
Well, and Gretel, thanks a lot. And, you know, Dana, earlier this year we did a two-part series on just educating the educators. In other words, this big debate over what teachers need in terms of an education before they even hit the public schools. So, Gretel, I really appreciate the point. And this comes up in the book, doesn't it, Dana?
Yes, I write about this a lot, and I'm really glad the point was made that teachers are highly educated and oftentimes have multiple advanced degrees, especially at the high school level, because I mentioned earlier the median pay is $54,000 per year, and that does not match other professions that have an equal requirement in terms of degrees. And, you know, especially for teachers in the first, you know, 10 or 15 years of the job, they don't get a lot of raises. It's very flat. And so this affects whether people choose to stay in the profession long term, and it also affects some people's decision about whether or not to become teachers in the first place.
There is some controversy, though, that you write about over teacher quality, teacher preparation and education. There's been some discussion about, you know, the SAT scores of teachers. Which colleges do they go to? Are they going to the sort of top tier or the sort of middle to bottom tier of American colleges? I mean, that's out there, too, Dana, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at teachers' grades and SAT scores, they are about average. You know, one thing I'll say is with 3.4 million teachers, which is a huge number of people, it's not totally surprising that they have average academic qualifications. We just need so many of them. You often hear the argument that teaching should be more elite, it should be more like law or medicine. However, we have five times as many teachers as we have lawyers or doctors. And I don't think it's realistic for that reason to only recruit teachers from top colleges or to only recruit teachers with 4.0 GPAs. What I talk about in terms of reforming teacher education in the book is the idea that teachers actually need an education that really teaches them classroom skills. And so I look at the residency model, which is where a teacher spends the college years really focusing on their subject matter, whether it's chemistry or biology or history. And then after that, they spend a full year as an apprentice teacher in a master teacher's classroom, learning, observing, truly getting those specific skills that they need to teach well.
Well, if people wanted, you know, teachers to be as highly educated as lawyers and doctors, you know, they'd have to pay teachers like lawyers and doctors, and I don't think anybody wants to do that.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that's not up for discussion. I mean, with the number of public teachers we have, you can imagine how expensive that would be.
Here's an email from Jack covering something that I did want to talk with you more about, Dana. So, Jack, thanks for the email. He says, Goals 2000, No Child Left Behind, Common Core, Race to the Top. Jack says, communities and school districts did a better job teaching school children before we were all conditioned to believe we can't do anything unless and until we get money and direction from Washington, D.C. This is a big theme in the book, Dana, you know, how much federal involvement we should have in our local schools.
Yeah, so I, you know, that's a good point. We have seen wave after wave of these attempts, often failed attempts, unfortunately, for the federal government to exert influence on local schools. I do think there is one thing that this national reform movement has brought to the table, which is very important. And that is a focus on closing achievement gaps. A lot of times we talk about the 30s or the 40s or the 50s as the golden age of American public education. But at that time, only 10% of kids were going to college. And today we have higher expectations. We know kids need more education to be successful in the economy. So I do think this reform conversation has led to some focus on making sure we're not leaving kids behind. And I don't use that as sort of a facile political phrase, but I really mean it.
Well, and to Jack's point, though, he lists, you know, again, all these education reform efforts that we've seen before. And another one he didn't mention, A Nation at Risk, which came out mm-hmm. in the 80s. I have heard from teachers, Dana, that, you know, they're tired of these efforts. And now at this point, when another one comes along, I had one teacher say to me, you know, I'm not going to worry about it because it's going to change in 3 years anyway. I mean, I think there's a reform fatigue to the point where teachers are like, eh, I'll just sort of pretend I'm going along with it, but they're going to change it in 5 years anyway, so why bother?
Right. You're absolutely right. There is a fatigue and a cynicism about these efforts because they don't take root. As soon as teachers get used to these new plans, they change. And so that's why the argument that I make in the book is that change needs to be seeded from the community level up, not from the top level down. And, you know, one of the ways to do that is to make sure that the really excellent teachers are sharing their insights and wisdom and their experience with the novice teachers, that there's more best practice sharing in the system from teacher to teacher. We often look to philanthropists or politicians for ideas about how to improve schools, but teachers have some of the best ideas, and they're not empowered in our current reform conversation.
Well, so how do we get around that? The next time there's an effort for nationwide school reform, does everybody at the local level say, just stop?
Well, I think at the local level, schools need to do some reorganization in how the workday is structured for teachers. So American teachers spend a lot more time in front of kids than teachers do in other countries. In other countries, teachers have time as adults to work with other adults to make sure the lessons are very strong, that they're planning the curriculum in a great way, that teachers are showing other teachers how to work more effectively with children. So that's something that individual schools can experiment with and try. In terms of whether the politics will catch up to that, I think the most important thing is for educators and for parents and voters to make their voices heard. If this reform movement is not working, it is really up to the public to spread that message.
I want to ask you about something else that you definitely cover in this book, Dana. There's been a lot of attention just lately to the question of why more men don't teach, especially at the elementary level. One of my sons, when he was little, he said to me one day, Mom, why aren't men allowed to teach? And I said, no, they are. They just, you haven't seen very many of them. You said earlier, Dana, that the public school workforce used to be almost exclusively male. And then you talked about how that changed. What's the impact of having so few men involved in public education? Because there's been a lot of angst about this lately.
Yeah, so 76% of American teachers are women, and the proportion is much higher in elementary classrooms. So your son is absolutely right. It can often look like we don't let men teach, but they are allowed. And why aren't they choosing to do it? I mean, I think a big part of it is the cultural bias and stereotype that it is a woman's job. And spending your whole day with young children is something women do. It's not something men do. Of course, there's the bias that women are sort of more naturally or biologically attuned to children. And all of this needs to be reversed for the teaching profession to have more prestige. Certainly, low pay is something that dissuades men from choosing this job. So it's, you know, we can't talk about all this without talking about the salaries that teachers earn. So it's a mix of things. It's the prestige and respect that's out there in the society for teachers. It's the pay. And it's just the fact that historically in America, since about the mid-19th century, it's been, you know, dominated by women. It's very hard to reverse those assumptions.
Well, and is there any evidence that kids suffer as a result? I mean, maybe it's fine that there aren't that many men. It's just the way it is. And, you know, no big deal.
Well, this is controversial. I mean, a lot of people argue that, you know, boys do better when they have male role models and that, you know, if you're a boy who's lucky enough to have a very loving and active father in your life, maybe this is not such a big deal, but if you don't have that active dad, maybe it would be great for you to have more male teachers. But, you know, generally, I do think it's good to have more men in the profession, both for boys to have role models, for girls to have role models who are men as well, and to increase the sense that this is a profession. It's not something that women are called to do or, you know, are naturally just doing because they love kids so much. Of course we want teachers to love kids. We want teachers to feel passionate about the work. But it is a job, and we have to professionalize it.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Jason and then an email from Rodney that I'll share with you because they both are making a similar point. So here's Jason's Facebook comment. He says, teachers are too often blamed for everything wrong with schools. There are certainly bad teachers, but there are far more of us trying to do the best we can with administrations that don't care to truly support us outside of lip service. Jason says, as administrators' salaries rise, I watch mine stagnate and my class sizes continue to rise. He says, to many teachers, this kills morale and makes them want to leave the profession. And then Rodney says, we tend to criticize teachers for problems over which they have no control. School administrators are trying to run a top-down organization in an environment where this does not work. Rod says, this is one of the reasons that 50% of new teachers quit after 5 years of constant frustration. So Jason and Rodney both saying, you know, look, teachers are frustrated and they quit. Can you talk about that high quit rate, Dana?
Yeah, so Rodney's statistic is exactly correct. It is about 50%
that
leave within
it's
50% in the first 5 years, especially in urban schools, actually. And what we know is we've asked teachers in these big surveys, why are you leaving? And this goes to Jason's point. They often say that they were not supported by their principal. The administration of the school was inept and did nothing to help them get better at their jobs and did nothing to recognize excellent teaching. And so we know that it's not just the teacher that we need to look at when we consider the people in this system, but it's also the principal and the administration who are creating the work environment for teachers.
Well, it's interesting. And in many workplaces, they have now what's called a 360 review where, you know, your supervisor not only reviews you, but you get to report back on your supervisor. With all these education reform efforts focused on teachers, Dana, I wonder, is anybody saying, hey, what about an accountability measure, some sort of data-driven assessment of principals and other school leaders? What about them?
Well, yes, Laura, people are saying that. But what they're often doing is just taking all of the test scores produced by all the teachers and then feeding that into a system to judge the principals. So oftentimes, instead of looking like holistically at the entire school and how is the principal doing and asking teachers, do you feel supported by this supervisor? It again becomes a very mechanistic test score based system. And I do think we need to have accountability for principals, but I think oftentimes with all the focus on test scores, it incentivizes the wrong measures.
Well, let's take one more call if we could. And this is Alex and Bo. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm an MIT professor, and I'm kind of the receiving end of all these kids. And let me just point out that, first of all, Dana should be the next Secretary of Education, period. So standardized anything is actually very boring, although necessary, like for nutrition or education. But if all we had to eat at was one type of restaurant, we would all be really sick.
Right.
So have Common Core, high standards for which to achieve, but let's pay and empower teachers to work with local businesses to understand what they, for the customers, need and want, and bring into the classroom, you know, examples from what kids will be expected to do when they graduate and they go work at companies, for example. And then let's trust the teachers to do what they need to do and back off. And I think Fareed Zakaria had a really nice TV show where he showed how what happened in Korea, which is number two in the world, horrible, but then you go to Finland, which is number one, and that's where the kids don't do any standardized tests. Taught to think, teachers are empowered.
Well, Alex, thanks for the call. And I think when he says, trust the teachers and back off, that's almost the title of one of your chapters or a heavy quote from a lot of teachers, at least. That's a theme, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, teachers said to me, like, I know what I'm doing, so please just let me do what I'm doing. And, you know, for a great teacher, that's a good idea. But for a teacher who's struggling, they do need more help. And what I say is that the good teacher needs to go help the bad teacher, as opposed to sort of an inept top-down reform effort that tries to control the bad teacher. Instead, we need to teach the bad teacher how to be a better teacher, in part because if we just take the strategy of getting rid of teachers, where are all the new ones going to come from? That's a challenge, too.
Well, Alex, thanks a lot for the call. And, you know, how do you do that when the teachers are turning over so quickly? You know, that 50% leave within 5 years. That's a topic for maybe another book, Dana. Thank you very much for being with us. Real interesting.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
That's Dana Goldstein. Again, she's the author of the brand new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.